Welcome to everyone around the world, all across the United States. And happy holidays to all of the Coast audience, coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. This is truly the hub of all things where we question coast to coast. And we get those answers, where we go into the night listening and wondering, how did we get here? I'm your host for the evening, Jimmy Church, sitting in for George Norrie, who is taking the night off. And I ask myself this question every single day. How did we get here? And when I try to find that answer, I'll tell you what I do. I seek out the very best. And Douglas Rushkoff has one of those minds that absolutely thinks forward. That's what he does. When it comes to technology, the internet, the corporations that are running the world today, and how things got to this point, it's Doug. How we got here. He is the one to listen to, seriously, and I do. Tonight, he joins me here with you to weave a mind-bending tale of iconography and mysticism set against the backdrop of a battle-torn Europe in a story spanning generations and featuring legendary occultist Aleister Crowley, who develops a powerful and dangerous new weapon to defend the world against Adolf Hitler's war machine, spawning an unconventional new form of warfare that is fought not with steel, but with symbols and ideas. And although this is a work of fiction and alternative history for sure, in the real world that we live in the now, that power and symbolism is exactly how corporations live and breathe in our daily lives. They are in control. They're in control of everything. So sit back, get comfortable. It's time to get our learn on. Sitting in for George Norrie on this Friday night, I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. You know the drill. I keep Twitter running live in real time to my left. Any questions or comments, I'm certainly going to catch them. It's Friday. You know what that means. So we're going to have open lines a little bit later. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'll be right back with my guest, Douglas Rushkoff. All right, welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, sitting in for George tonight, taking the night off. It's going to be one of those nights tonight we're going to get our education on. And it's very important that we all just sit back and get comfortable and listen to what Douglas has to say. Douglas Rushkoff is a writer. He's a documentarian. He's a lecturer whose work focuses on human autonomy in the digital age. He is the author of 15 best-selling books on media, technology, and society, including Program or Be Programmed, Present Shock, and Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. Great video series on that online if you want to go check that out. He has made such award-winning PBS Frontline documentaries as Generation Like, Merchants of Cool, and The Persuaders. And he's the author of graphic novels, including Testament and what we're going to talk about tonight, Aleister and Adolf. Rushkoff is the recipient of the Marshall McLuhan Award for his book, Coercion, the Jacques Ellul Award for his documentary, The Merchants of Cool, and the Neil Postman Award for Career Achievement in Public Intellectual Activity, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He is responsible for originating such concepts as viral media, social currency, and digital natives. Today, Dr. Rushkoff serves as professor of media theory and digital economics at CUNY Queens, where he recently founded the Laboratory for Digital Humanism and hosts its Team Human podcast. Of course, you can find his website, rushkoff.com, over at Coast to Coast. You can follow him on Twitter, at Rushkoff. And I would like to welcome back to Coast, Dr. Douglas Rushkoff. Good evening, Doug. How are you?
Hey, Jimmy. I'm good. Great to be with you here on the main stage.
It's been 3 years, Doug, since you've been on Coast. What have you been up to?
Oh, my gosh. 3 years. I guess three books, a documentary, a graphic novel. The world developed further along. It's accelerated on its little path, maybe faster than I thought.
Let me ask you this. I'm going to start here, and I know you're going to expect this, but one of the 10 most influential intellectuals in the world by MIT is pretty heavy, my friend. Do you have to choose your words carefully now because of that?
No, you would think. I mean, that'd be the temptation, huh? But I think what makes you an influential intellectual is the more you can get that filter off, you know, and say what you're actually thinking before you have time to edit it down. Because sometimes, I guess, the subconscious brain can express deeper thoughts sometimes than your filters want to permit you to see.
Yeah, you know, that's such a heavy, heavy thing to have on your shoulders. And did you speak the same way before that, you know, or, you know, did you change your approach to things? Because now more people are listening and certainly taking you serious because of these awards and some of the stuff that has come in your direction.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm a little bit careful not to spin things too apocalyptic sometimes, because I know now there's, you know, college people and, you know, people who are still idealistic and optimistic listening. So, you know, I try to couch negativity and instead talk about, well, what can we actually do, you know, to make things better rather than dwelling on, you know, what's going to happen if we don't.
Can we slow down? Can we slow down the progress that we have made in this last 20 years, 10 years? Are we able to pump the brakes on this machine and change direction, or are we stuck?
I mean, I think we can, but the problem is we can't think of it as taking our hands off the wheel and pumping on the brakes.
Right.
You know, there's that phenomenon that happens when if you're whitewater rafting and the waves get really, really choppy, your impulse is to pull your oar right out of the water. But what you actually have to do is put your oar in the water and you have to row more heavily. You have to actually exert more will, not less will. So really what I'm trying to help people do is muster the will to exercise human intervention in the machine. You know, I don't think the problem right now is people. I think the problem right now is the operating system that we're running on, the number of things we take automatically, the constructs that we mistake for features of nature that we accept as pre-existing conditions, you know, whether that's the way the market works or the power the corporations have over us or you know, the way we relate to spirituality and what's possible, or worse, the way we relate to technology, the way we look at our iPhones and, you know, let those apps play us more than we play them. You know, we have phones that literally get smarter about us with every swipe that we make. That's why they call them smartphones. While we get dumber about them and how they operate. And that puts us more and more at the mercy of systems rather than human will, rather than our agency. So the way to slow it down is really to speed us up, you know, is to acknowledge that we're letting a machine run on automatic and letting it control us, and instead just figuring out what is it that makes us human? What are the anomalous behaviors and weird, strange things about us that can let us express human will into some of these systems?
Well, and speaking of that, in your new graphic novel, which is beautifully illustrated by Michael Oeming, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but in this book, some of these concepts are woven into that story too as well. Did you feel the need to do this book in an illustrated form to help along these concepts?
Yeah, I mean, well, some of the concepts that I'm talking about, the stuff that that Aleister Crowley used to do, and then, as I'm arguing in the book, you know, migrated over into advertising.
Right.
It was really the creation of corporate icons. You know, most simply, let's just think of them, even corporate logos, you know, the McDonald's arches or the big GE swirl, and those brands, the brand mythologies and the brand iconography really comes from the practice of sigil magic, which was the creation of little icons that represented, you know, the magician's will, what they wanted to see happen. And a lot of nasty people use these kind of icons, like Hitler, for example, used a powerful or a version of a powerful old icon in the swastika. And, you know, eventually the kind of magic that was used to charge those sigils and give them some power over us ended up, you know, in the corporate sphere.
It's funny that you mentioned the power of the swastika, because today all it does is evoke emotion from everybody. Such a powerful, if you ever wonder the power of a symbol, there's your example right there.
Right. And the interesting thing is, of course, it means different things to different people. You know?
Right.
People that are using it, it means one thing. And to us, it means something else. And really, almost all sigils can be looked at that way. You know, I remember I used to tell my daughter when she was just 18 months, you know, I had read a piece in Adweek that said that McDonald's imprints its arch on people. They're aiming for 18 months old kids is when they want to anchor that image. So every time we'd pass the McDonald's arch in the car, this is, she could barely talk, I would say, honey, see that big yellow sign? That means poison. So, and to this day, when she sees the arch, she doesn't think, oh, Ronald McDonald or McDonald's kids. She thinks poison.
So, you know,
almost any icon can be turned, you know, and the power of that icon, you know, can be turned against itself.
Yeah, I used to pick up my daughter from preschool. You know, she's 3 years old. And across the street on Ventura Boulevard here in the Valley was a McDonald's. And she's in the back seat, right, in her baby seat. And we pull out of that parking lot. And it was like the first, I think she learned dad and then McDonald's, you know, in that order. And I had to pull out in front of it every single day. But the question that I opened with today for the show is, how did we get here? You know, we look around today at the technology and the control and corporations dominating Washington and the world, for that matter, dictating everything in our daily lives from the moment that we wake up until we go to bed. How did we get here? It doesn't seem like it was like this in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s, but here today, it's everything, everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple of different starting points we could use. You know, this one that we've just gone through, this thing that seems to have happened to us, you know, since the 80s or so, you know, we all know it has something to do with digital technology, but, you know, we're not sure exactly what, because the technology itself didn't need to do this to people. You know, we could be using it as we want to and when we want to, rather than being stuck in this weird always on universe where we're pinged all the time. You know, that seems like a choice. So I kind of looked back to, you know, when I was around and you were, you know, when we were first playing with these technologies and thinking about, how did it take this turn? And did that turn have something to do with the situation we've ended in? And, you know, what I concluded was, you know, when we first got these technologies, they were really enhancing of the human experience. We used digital technology in an asynchronous way. That means we understood that it doesn't live in real time with us. It's a sequenced technology. So we used it to make more time for us. I remember I used to go on the Well. It was one of those electronic bulletin board, these conversations. But the way you would participate in a conversation is you would log into the computer and then use your modem and log onto the bulletin board and download the conversation, go back offline, and then read this whole conversation and spend maybe an hour or two crafting your response, how you were going to speak. Then you'd upload it, and the internet became this place where you were literally smarter than you are in real life.
Right.
Imagine that. You know, and then, you know, these technologies, they didn't really make money for media companies, for advertisers. They did a study where they found the average internet user is watching 9 hours less television a week. You know, so the corporations came back and instead they said, look, this internet thing, this is just what we need to expand our markets. You know, we ran out of room on the planet. We've marketed television and our products to everybody, but the internet's going to create new surface area, you know, new virtual territory where we can do more marketing and more selling. You know, the only problem was there's only so much human time. So they started to use technologies really to mine human beings for their time. They call it eyeball hours. That's the number of hours that they can get your eyeballs looking at their screen. So now all of our devices are being programmed by the smartest kids coming out of Stanford to really use psychological techniques, good old Pavlovian responses and Freudian techniques and new design theories to draw us in, to addict us to one app or the other or staring at a screen, you know, rather than staring at one another. And once we lose that person-to-person contact in the real world, that peer-to-peer contact that the internet originally seemed to foster rather than deny us, when we start losing that sense of solidarity with each other, we get really untethered. You know, if you're not using people in your community for a sense of navigation, for a sense of direction as your moral compass, then you're going to use whatever kind of road signs you recognize out there, what you're looking at. And for us, that's brands. You know, those recognizable brands and names serve like anchors in this digital world where we're very untethered, where we're constantly being pinged and interrupted. You know, when we have devices strapped to our bodies that vibrate every time someone, you know, tweets about us or Facebooks on our page, you know, we live in this state of perpetual emergency interruption that, you know, air traffic controllers and telephone, you know, emergency operators used to live in. You know, only they did it 4 hours at a time and they were paid for it, you know, and we do it as our choice. So I think what's really so different is our relationship to what's going on. There's a feeling that you're just a leaf in a gale, watching society change beneath your feet and watching your own behaviors change, you know, without really being aware enough of this environment and who controls it in order to really exercise your own intentions.
Is our DNA actually changing? You know, are our brains starting to rewire ourselves for future generations where they are now acclimated to this type of focus? If you walk around a campus or a grade school, junior high school, and just stand there while you're waiting for your kids to come, they are walking in robots looking at cell phones, you know, 1,000 kids. And is it starting to change our DNA? What are the generations of the future going to be like with these, you know, rewired cortexes?
Well, you know, human beings change on two really distinct timescales. You know, the DNA timescale, it's based on, it's not like our DNA gets changed by the environment so much as, you know, there's a random change and then someone might be able to operate better. So if at some point there might be someone born who does cell phones better and then survives better in our world and has more kids, but that's a really long haul. The more immediate changes are to the individual organism, you know, and the earlier you interact with something, the more you'll be changed by it. You know, our brains have a property called neuroplasticity, which means that they adapt not on a DNA level, but they adapt, their structures change in the way that they connect, the way the brain connects to other parts of the brain. Those change, new pathways come. So if you're a young kid and your brain is developing, which it is really till you're around 27 years old, if you're spending your time, you know, looking at people through a Skype screen, you know, and not training yourself the way all humans have for hundreds of thousands of years to see subconsciously whether someone's irises are getting bigger or smaller while you're talking to them, you know, then you don't develop rapport with other people. And then you're just not as social. So yeah, and then you've wired yourself to be a less social person, someone who receives fewer of the cues from other people. So yeah, when you look at those kids, they are different. They are being trained by these little devices and not in a way that necessarily, at least to my mind, is an improvement.
And I'll tell you what's fascinating. We're going to take a break right here, but I'll tell you what is really fascinating if you think about it. In 20 years, in the last 20 years, how many around the world and across the United States wake up in the morning, sit up in bed, and pick up their cell phone before coffee, before breakfast, before good morning to your kids, before the shower? That is your routine now. It has certainly taken over our lives. Our guest tonight, Douglas Rushkoff. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, sitting in for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. It's Friday night. That means open lines in just a little bit. Stay with us. All right, welcome back to Coast. Our guest tonight is Douglas Rushkoff, tech visionary, author, documentarian, professor, amongst other things. And we're talking about his new book that he did with Michael Avon Oeming, and he was the illustrator on it. And what I want to talk about, Doug, right here is the fighting of a war machine against Hitler without steel, but with iconography and symbols and ideas. What exactly are we talking about?
It's interesting, you know, before the war, Aleister Crowley met Adolf Hitler. Now, Aleister Crowley was this British occultist, and you know, famously, you know, the world's evilest man for, you know, doing tarot and sigil magic and all sorts of rituals. And he, when he came back, he wrote this letter where he said, "I had never met someone so demonic as Herr Hitler. You know, why do you think I spent so much time with him and went when he bade me? I tell you that only the universe can prevail against Hitler. But the universe, meaning God, doesn't seem to be interested." And it was at that moment that Crowley decided that Hitler was winning this war, not just because he had, you know, better tanks, but because he was using magic, that the Holocaust and the burning of all the Jews and all was a way for Hitler to charge a magical sigil, to charge his swastika and convince people to follow him. And Crowley saw that as black magic, as the dark magic, and wanted to do a counter sigil. He wanted to use magic against Hitler. And so he came up with a sigil, a V sigil, to counteract Hitler. You know, and he just loved, he thought that the V as a sign could bring down the swastika as a sign. He thought it was a more potent image. He said, you know, it was based on the Hebrew vav, which is phallic, and it means nail, which he would think to mean nails in Hitler's coffin, and it was part of an old temple motto, VVVV, and it was according to Golden Dawn's formula, V designated the Egyptian deities of Apophis and Typhon, you know, deities suggesting a tarot card of the devil, which he thought was appropriate since V also represents a pair of horns. And he also liked V for Veni, Vidi, Vici, you know, I came, I saw, I conquered. And his motto, which was V, is for victory. So what he did was got in touch with the British Secret Service, a lot of them who were in his coven. And one of them, Ian Fleming, you know, the famous James Bond author.
Sure.
He was in the MI5 and had a direct line to Churchill. And through him, Crowley gave Churchill the V is for victory sign, where you hold up, you know, your hand in the little peace sign, but, you know, backwards, as something that he should do. And then Churchill started flashing that sign everywhere he went, and it changed sentiment about the war. And ultimately, Crowley would argue it was part of the necessary magic to counteract what Hitler was doing.
Now, and corporations, companies, automakers, everybody that was involved with the war effort incorporated the V for victory sign and their posters and advertising, and it was pretty effective.
Oh, yeah, it was deeply effective. And the question, you know, that I always have about it is, you know, was it effective as like magic, or was it effective just as the kind of magic of suggestion that you make people believe? If you change the way people think about something or feel, then you end up changing the way they behave. Or was it magic in the sense of, you know, some supernatural effect of one thing, you know, of one thing over the other?
Isn't that the same thing? Would it matter?
I know, does it? Right.
Right.
And I think that's what Crowley is saying. That's what Crowley believes, which is part of why Crowley hated black magic. You know, you don't have to kill someone to charge a sigil if the whole thing is a psych out in one way or the other. You know, so that's why the main character in my comic, I make him a young American military kid who's trying to, well, he's trying to enlist Crowley in an effort to steal back the spear of destiny, which is an occult object that that Hitler had. But I make him someone who starts out not believing in anything, and then when he sees how the magic works, he thinks it's absolutely real. So he becomes a true believer in the magic of magic. And Crowley is trying to say to him, this is why I enjoyed making Crowley this kind of character. Crowley is saying, you know, sort of what Laurence Olivier said to Dustin Hoffman when he was having his teeth pulled out to practice for Marathon Man. He said, you know, my dear boy, haven't you ever heard of acting? You know, and that's sort of what Crowley is trying to say to this young American. It's like, my dear boy, it's magic. It's a show. It's a psych out. Don't take it that seriously. You know, but he does. And that's the character that ends up kind of birthing the American advertising industry, because now he understands really how to charge corporate sigils with the same kinds of magic that Hitler and Crowley were using.
For Crowley to call out Hitler as the most evil thing ever that he's encountered or met or spoken to is kind of strange, because that is exactly the way that the world was looking at Alistair at the time too as well. Are we misunderstanding who the real Alistair was, or was just evil understanding evil here?
Well, it's not to say, you know, Crowley doesn't have to be the evilest man in the world not to be a saint either, you know, but Crowley's magic was benevolent and meant so. It was not, it was not trying to bring down the world. You know, England, especially sort of late Victorian and then World War One era England, was not into the occult logic of an Adolf Hitler. This is, you know, the beginning of the Industrial Age, really. You know, that wasn't the way they were thinking about things. So they saw, you know, they saw him, any kind of, you know, witchcraft as the devil. And Crowley, you know, didn't mind publicity. And when he was called the devil or the beast, as they usually called him, he welcomed it. You know, it was, it was publicity. It was, increasing the kind of the amount of power he had, because fear is better than nothing.
Well, were the other people around Hitler recognizing the darkness the way that Alistair seemed to see it straight away? You know, is it because Alistair understood, what to look for?
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, the people around him definitely were occultists too. You know, Himmler was, you know, a full-fledged man of magic, and he, as soon as the Nazis took power, he took control of what they used to call the Office of Ancestral Research, and he really turned it into the SS Occult Bureau. You know, they called it the Witchcraft Special Commission, and the idea was to recover the lost wisdom of the German folk. But in the process, they also rounded up all of the competing occult societies, you know, Crowley's among them, and put their adherents in the camps. You know, they wanted to get rid of all magical competition.
With the Vril, the Thule, all of the other dark occult things that they were into, the northern traditions of Europe, certainly Eastern mysticism too, they really got into all of it. Were you aware of all of these occult groups going into research this book?
No, not at all. I mean, all I knew was, you know, that Hitler was into astrology, and that, you know, there in a lot of the documentaries, they say how he timed certain troop movements to different, you know, things that were going on in the stars. But I didn't realize it was, a complicated, a history of vying sects of different lodges, you know, moving in, and that there was this other almost a weird occult gentleman's war going on, you know, beneath the surface of all the real killing.
Right. We have to jump into a break right here. We'll be right back. Our guest tonight, Douglas Rushkoff. We're talking about his new illustrated novel, Alistair and Adolf. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, Douglas Rushkoff. We're talking about his new illustrated novel, Alistair and Adolf. Now, Doug, how did you meet Michael Oeming? Because what's strange for me here, it's a small world, but he has done all of our artwork over for my radio show, right? He's done a lot of illustrating for us. And he's one of the great comic illustrators in the world. He's one of the top guys. But this is just a coincidence that he is also doing this book. And he's amazing. How did you find him?
It is interesting, though. I mean, if you believe in connections, it certainly it ended up bringing me back to you.
Right, right.
Too. It kind of went full circle. It's weird. You know, I originally, I started this book, you know, 4 years ago, and it was doing it with Dark Horse and an artist, and a weird kind of tragedy befell that artist. So then we had to find another one, and then a weird tragedy befell that guy, and then we got a third artist, and a weird thing happened to him. And then I lost my editor, and then a new guy, Dan Chabon, picked it up, and he the next day gave me a list of 10 artists that could do it, and I looked, and the second one on the list was Michael, and I looked at his work, and instantly it was like, oh my God. It was like, you know, that love at first sight thing when I saw that he could do two things. You know, one, he understood that every panel of a comic is a sigil, that each one of these is a drawing in which you invest not just not just energy into the scene that you're drawing, but the composition of the panel itself. The way all the elements come together is meant to create almost a kind of a gestalt response. It's a sigil. And I was like, oh my God, this is a guy who will understand that the comic itself is the sigil, that we're not just showing other people's sigils, but making a new one. We're counteracting the spell of all of this corporate magic with a comic book that reveals it, that exposes it, but that he would get that. And at the same time, you look at his characters and they are acting so well. It's like these are comic book characters doing Oscar performances. You know, it's the expressions. They're just so honest that you see through them to what they're feeling, not just what they're saying. You know, so it becomes almost like this immersive movie when you move through one of his books. And then I did some research on it because I wanted to see, is the guy healthy? Is he okay? You know, that maybe I felt bad about bringing someone else in, that something bad might happen, but he seemed weird enough and stable enough. You know, he's married, he's healthy, he's muscular, you know, and he's comfortable surfing these kind of outer edges of consciousness. You know, these are some scary places we inhabit. Some, as all your listeners know, these are edge phenomenon and experiences that we're having and talking about. And he seemed used to it enough that I didn't think whatever was going on with this book was gonna damage him too much.
Well, it's one thing if you're doing superheroes, and he is one of the top artists, right? He's one of the best, and his stuff is great. But he is fully engaged into conspiracy and to the fringe. He understands it, and some of his comic books are actually exactly on that, like Mice Templar, for example. You know, he is fully educated in all things esoteric and fringe and paranormal. He understands it, and it was just a magical find for this book.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also, and you know, we talk about it a lot, you and I too. I mean, he's into history. If you're into the Knights Templar, then you're into the big transition. Then you're into the big scary transition between a medieval people-based society to, you know, what happened at the end of medievalism is when the corporations were born and central currency was born and we moved into a corporatist society, you know, and you really got to be able to go back to when people were in charge to reconnect with some of these insights and abilities. And, you know, when you see that Michael spends a lot of time back there too, I realize, okay, he's grounded in, he found the same vein, you know, and he's been sucking off that same great teat of knowledge.
Right.
So it's like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Now, the other thing that I want to touch upon, and we need to get this in, and we're going to be taking calls here in the next hour or two as well, which is the global AI that is Google and some of these other instruments that are a living, breathing machine that is now thinking just like us and is now almost ahead of the curve, and we're starting to approach that singularity. Is it real? I mean, it is a fear, and it is 1984 for real, but is it?
Oh, it's real. It's real. It's as real as a corporate sigil, you know, as a corporate sigil living inside a robot. I mean, that's why in the comic, you know, I framed the comic with a really, the story gets told to a young, you know, web designer who's doing the early World Wide Web, putting corporate logos on the web, and they're moving around, and he doesn't understand what's going on, which is why he goes to the old head of this ad agency and gets the whole, you know, Crowley-Hitler story. But that's a weird moment, because what really started to happen in the 90s, when they decided to make the web corporate, to make the net about promoting the economy rather than promoting humanity, is we gave corporations bodies for the first time. They used to just be on paper and contracts in a drawer. You know, once you put them online, whether it's their marketing abilities, you know, or just giving a giving an AI to a website so it knows how to sell something to you better than a regular catalog page, you know, what we're doing is allowing these very potent programs, these corporations, which were already brands, already mythologies, and we're letting them migrate into an interactive space. We're giving them intelligence in the form of AI and having these corporations quite literally evolve, right? We're not evolving, you know, as we've talked about before. We're not evolving that fast, but they're changing their code to better and better manipulate us. And then when you realize that the chief scientist at Google, you know, the hero there, is a guy who literally believes that machines are going to become conscious and smarter than people. And when that moment happens, what they call the singularity, he and many people like him believe that human beings will only be necessary insofar as we keep the machines going. That if computer consciousness is superior to human consciousness, then we should, you know, just bow down to our evolutionary successors, you know, pass the torch. And that's really strange, especially when, no matter how smart computers are, we don't really have a way of knowing if they're conscious. I mean, it could just be the machine. And what these proponents of the singularity and building a new brain down at Googleplex somewhere, you know, for the future of consciousness to live, you know, what they don't realize is that their agenda dovetails perfectly well with that of the corporation, with that of corporate capitalism that was born, and not good old capitalism, but the corporate capitalism that was born at the end of medievalism, which was invented, you know, very quite explicitly to squash the rise of human beings and to keep the kings and their corporations in power.
We're going to hit a break right here. I want a date out of you. I want a year, just a year. Kurzweil has given us a window. Singularity could be as soon as 2018 to 2030, 32. That's a 12, 14-year window. Really quick, how close are we? Do you have a date?
The date I would give you, say maybe something like 2040, wouldn't be of the singularity happening, but of us being stupid enough to think it had.
Okay, there you go. 2040 from Douglas Rushkoff. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We're going to be taking your calls next. Stay with us.